Today is August 27th. We're back with God and Man. And I left you with, at the end of last class, with the question about this pasuk: Lo asochein chogoy umishpatim bal yidahum. Hallelujah. It's a pasuk at the end of Perek Kuf Mem Zayin. But it's in the Dabi, right? Lo asochein chogoy umishpatim bal yidahum. Hallelujah. What does it mean? The nations of the world don't know from Mishpatim? How can you even fathom such an interpretation in light of the introduction I gave you last class? Right? We're going to compare the laws, especially of Parshas Mishpatim, some Parshas Kisetse, we'll contrast a little bit here and there, with ancient Near Eastern law. Call that cuneiform law, and we'll see that there are law codes in the ancient world, in Babylonian, Sumerian, and Egypt, and many other places, that long predate the Matan Torah, long predate Abraham. So what does this pasuk mean? Right?
No moral code, moral laws.
Exactly. Another great answer. Exactly. You ever see there's some clips that go around now of Hibri Machshavo, some of his early speeches about Judaism, and he says that Judaism messed up this whole world, and because they gave the world a conscience, and they gave the world morality. I'm going to create a perfect race and a perfect society. We don't have to worry about these untermenschen and these under. When if a child is born crippled, we're going to kill that child without any compunction and any conscience, because That child is going to be such a drain on the people who need society. Did you ever read the book The Giver?
Yes, very good.
Did you see the movie? The movie was really changed the book a little bit. I read it. But the book is about a very well-moving and very well-churning society. But there too, if a kid is born and is not sizing up to what a kid is supposed to be, just a doctor without any emotion at all gives him a little syringe, puts him in a box, puts him down the chute. That no emotion, he doesn't even realize he's killing a kid. And the society works so well, and it's such a well-greased machine, and everything is so perfect and beautiful. That's what he wanted to do. No morality, no conscience. The interests of the stronger. Are you familiar with Plato's Republic? Some of the ideas of virtue. The interests of the stronger. Why should we worry about this one drain on society? Just get out of here. Come on, man is God's image. By the way, Hitler's 1,000-year plan was to go after Christianity, right after Judaism. Right? He claimed Christianity is the bastard son of Judaism. Right? So that's exactly the point. Is that the purpose of law for ancient man was to have a well-orderly, ordered society, secure from any threat, right? A society that works well but has no inclination towards morality. And they worshipped God, their gods, in the same way. If you ask any pagan in Babylonia, their god was the king who presented these laws, you know? You could claim that he's a god. Manufacture these laws and create all of these. So you have to worship him. So, if you ask them, what are you worshiping your God for? Very utilitarian. I see I need rain in the season. I see the crops to work. I need security for my neighbors. Right? And I'm going to give my God back what he needs in order to be strong to give me these things. And how do I know what that God needs? My high priest tells me. What are those things? Almost every society back then, my firstborn child, who loves the blood of children, a virgin here and there, right? Harvest season, wow, I've got to give a lot of heart, we'll come back, put it right in the mouth of that God, who loves meat more than vegetables, but we give him everything. Wine, oil, right? So, it's interesting because
our code in Parshas Mishpatim, which we're going to analyze, has no reference to sacrifice, right? Animal sacrifice. It's going to come later. Remember, we talked about Didu Kaps Ushakur last class, the three different types of details of the Torah, rituals, law, heroic stories of special people.
Is there a lesson involved
for Shapru? I imagine that when an ancient Babylonian was reading about their ancient heroes, who, by the way, lived 70,000 years, 85,000 years, it's amazing. They also have flood stories, all of them, but they also have the people who lived long before them lived these amazingly... you know, I guess if you can live 960 years, you can also live 96,000 years. But their lifespans are way out there. In the Sumerian and Egyptian ancient histories of... I imagine whatever type of lifestyle they lived. This man freely gave 17 children from 17 different wives. What a righteous man that is. Right? They used to have to protect these huge drums while they throwing the kids in the fire so they could drown out the screams. Right? The real tragedy is that we see in some prophecies of Tanakh that sometimes Jews did the same. Like Jews to this day, assimilation, to be similar to the people around them, they said, all right, they're doing it, that seems to get them to be successful. Except King Yamani, I'll also do it. So that's a terrible story. Yirmiyahu chapter 7. And also at the very end of his book, he talks about this terrible practice of child sacrifice. So this is what they did. They did it for security. And I'm sure they didn't do it for morality, because the gods, they're worshipping themselves by their own writings about the behavior of their gods, is not a moral god. What's my proof? look at some of the Greek stories of their gods. They don't do things morally. They steal from each other. They cheat from each other. They try to outsmart each other. Right? They sometimes steal a particularly beautiful human being and make her something of a goddess and have children with her, or create a demigod or something like that. We see that that's precisely the difference, is that our law code is, yes, of course, supposed to lead to security and an orderly society, but that's not the point. The point is to create a moral individual who will see every other individual, especially the weaker ones, to be protected by you. The most commonly repeated mitzvah in the Torah is the fair treatment of the ger, the stranger. Don't get me wrong, there are some Egyptian monarchs who also work for the orphan and the widowed. Yes, we do see that cropping up there. You don't take them off as well, you have no one to take care of them, let's just kill them off. No, I don't want to just sweep that under the carpet. It does exist in some places, but the overall framework, that the purpose of our law is to create a certain cultural milieu. We'll see that manifesting itself in certain areas of difference, like large differences, right? And Parshas Mishpatim begins with the ownership of another human being. Now, I would have liked a nice Lincoln-esque pasuk at the beginning of Mishpatim to say, you just left Egypt, you knew what it was like to be owned by another person, I am abolishing slavery altogether. No slavery. Not a Jew on a Jew, not a Jew for a Gentile, no ownership of another person. Right? So, on one level, we should put that in the back of our heads, because we have a certain, we feel that the Torah is everlasting, and with my sensitivity today, right, has something to say about what the Torah meant 3,500 years ago, but it's crucial not to feel we always have the right to impose my moral sensitivities today on the Torah, given in a very different framework. But instead of just outlawing it altogether, it's curtailed, it's defined, it's very, very well defined, but here's another point that is crucial, and that's this front page here. Okay, the way to do this, you have to read it like this, because every page is upside down. right? You have to look. You have to take it like this and then just read it like this. Otherwise, the page is going to be a little flippant. Okay? Why did I start with the introduction to Bava Kamma? Because the point I'm going to use the Silol again and again is that our law codes cannot be read without an oral tradition. The Code of Hammurabi does not have an oral tradition. It's very clear. You read the line and it says, "If you kill your son, your son gets killed." I don't need an oral tradition for what that means. And none exists. Frankly, there are no Babylonians who have been studying the Code of Hammurabi with an uninterrupted line from then till today. So no one really cares. But when I'm saying ki tikne eved ivri, there's something so obvious in those words that the reader of the Torah just assumes. How did he get to be an eved ivri? You talk about that. I didn't even buying each other? No. I need Baba Kamma to tell me how did he become an eved ivri? Tell me. How did you come to be owned? How did you come to be owned by another Jew? Only one way. Well, I shouldn't say that, sorry. So why are we in the Sefer Kiddushin to Machlokes Tam Kamma Rav Elozer? He stole and he couldn't pay back. And then Kar Bignei Boso. Right? You're familiar with that institution, right? If you stole, it was a very rare thing. If you stole and you couldn't pay it back, not the kefil, just what you stole, then you get sold into slavery. Who would want to have someone living in his home who just stole from me? Slavery was meant to be rehabilitated. Right? And you know what? You have to pay for the education of his children. His wife has to move in also. Who knows? Maybe this guy was homeless. This guy didn't quite like this. Right? There's so much behind the two words, Eved Ivri. How did he get to be an Eved? Right? So that there is the Torah requires Torah Shabbat Peh. The written law requires oral tradition. Without it, we are lost. And that oral tradition has been passed down orally. Right? And it comes down to us in the form of Bava Kamma today. Right? And the traditions of how to understand these laws. Okay? Good? So, yes, it would have been very nice if the Torah just started Parshas Mishpatim. No, don't own another human being. Comes the Torah and says, no, there's an institution called Eved Ivri, and there are two ways to become an Eved Ivri. One, you stole and can't pay back. And two, it's called Mocher et Atzmo Mishum Dochako. Hear that again? Mocher et Atzmo Mishum Dochako. He sells himself into servitude because he is impoverished. He wants to be, but I think... That the English translation, the English language does not come up with a good word for this. What do you say it means? Slave. Especially here in America and in the 19th century, we don't have a good picture of what this means. This is not what it means. It's not a slave, not abad. Like the name of Vajra, more like the Arabic abad means to, or the Aramaic abad means to do. Someone who does things for you. Right? It could be a personal secretary. It could be a butler. Right? It's wrong to translate that as a Hebrew slave. The Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin has five or six lines. All the scriptures of what you not have to tell him to do. All the things that you the obligations you have on his family makes it so that the Gemara says Hakone Eved La'atzmo Kono Adon La'atzmo. You purchase a Hebrew slave, you have purchased a Hebrew master. Your job is to rehabilitate the person. Right?
Why would I have a wall with?
Right.
You're
right.
You could be him first.
Good. You're right. I wanted to be his. But is included in the Torah. Why does Parshas Mishpatim begin with such a law of Eved Ivri? It's possibly because the former slave makes the worst master. You'd think otherwise, right? But you know, it's intuitively you think otherwise, but no. A child who is abused as a child tends to abuse other children. You think and say, I'm never doing that to someone else. Right? So someone who was formerly abused as a slave makes a very bad master. So the Torah says you were formerly slaves. I'm telling you the fair treatment of the Eved right now. Do not veer off this type of way. Right? You must free him after a certain amount of time. The Eved, I'm going to use the word slave from now on. The Eved, who probably an indentured servant might be better. The Eved who sells himself into slavery is not for 6 years. It says as long as you want. Alright? And for that I get my children's education, my health care, place to live, food. Alright? So what I told you before, about 10 minutes ago, would have been very nice if there was a Lincoln-esque statement, Emancipation Proclamation. You were just slaves for such a long time, you knew how bad it was, just end it. No, instead the Torah tells us of an institution that if wrongly, if learned improperly, without a Torah Shabbat path, without the understanding of what the word really means in Hebrew, again, closer to the Aramaic, Abad, my Abad means, what are you doing here? Right? So then you might draw the wrong conclusion. Right? What's interesting is that we're going to be analyzing these Mishnayos, but also towards the end, turn this around to the other side, and you see a number of pages from a book called... The book is called Cuneiform Law. Right? This is a chapter on the laws of the Book of the Covenant. Chapter on the Book of the Covenant is known as Parshas Mishpatim. And it compares every pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, casuistic laws, meaning if you guys say, and not the apocalyptic laws, because there are none to compare with, but from the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim all the way till like the middle of the Parsha, it compares line by line everything about Parshas Mishpatim with ancient laws. Okay? So you know, I start with the Our Torah Shebaal Peh, and we're going to compare it as necessary to the rules of that to us aware of an ancient world. And Shalom Paul, that is the author of the book, Shalom Paul, he points out to some interesting stark contrasts. The Torah is the only. I mean, actually, this is not from Shalom Paul. This is from Yechezkel Kaufman. Heard the name Yechezkel Kaufman? He wrote a book in Hebrew called Toldot Emunat Yisrael. Toldot Emunat Yisrael, translated by a man named Moshe Greenberg into a book called The History of the Israelite Religion, in which he compares every aspect of Dinu, Kavsu, and Shapru to over 100 ancient religions. 105 to be exact. Over 100 ancient religions. He compares the stories of Torah, the laws of Torah, the heroes of the Torah, right? And he points to some interesting things that one particular point that relates to this our discussion of slavery. He says that Torah is the only ancient code that carries the death penalty for kidnapping. This is harsh. And in Parshas Gonev Ish Umechoro Mosumas. You sell someone, you kidnap someone, and you either work them or sell them, you get killed for that. He said, I searched every ancient code for their rules of kidnapping, and they show up all over the place. You have their rules of kidnapping. Because it was done. Right? Okay? So, why does the Torah have such a profoundly more stringent punishment for kidnapping than everything else out in the ancient world? Can you come up with a thought? Another interesting difference in Parshas Mishpatim is it's the only law code of the ancient world that carries the death penalty for beating parents. Some other civilizations have some very creative punishments for beating your parents. But the Torah, draconian, you're dead. Punch your parent in the nose and the nose bleeds, you've committed murder. Torah Shavuot Peh says it has to draw blood. To the point where the post can ask the question, if the child is a, can a child draw blood and take, give insulin to the parents, because it sometimes draws blood. So what? Can you interpret these two? Come on, let's talk. Be proactive here. Why is the Torah so much more draconian than all ancient law about kidnapping?
Is it reacting to the story?
Of course. We just left servitude. These people spent 200 years, or let's say 100 years or more, in with our liberty denied. It's so obvious in the ancient world that people are like animals, they're cattle. Look, until 150 years ago, people from Africa were treated the same way. Right? These people were born to serve our interests. They're weaker, they're in chains, and they will continue to serve our interests, and we will raise them that way. Right? So this is the ancient man was like this. Right? So here comes the Torah and says, you remember what it was like to have your liberty denied by a nation that said, well, that's just the way it is. Sorry, you're born on the wrong side. So if someone amongst you behaves in the same way and denies someone his liberty, I must... Is it deterrent? Is it punishment? What is it? So I hope it's deterrent. But you know what? History shows that death penalties, for instance, for murder, has not been much of a deterrent. People feel they get away with it. They hear the moment they have to kill that guy for what he did to me. Is it the fact that they'll kill me for that a deterrent? Doesn't seem to work that way. The Torah, however, says that the punishment for taking a life, is such a serious infraction. Only proper punishment for such a thing can be that the person forfeits his own life. Right? Okay. So this is the correct answer to our problem. The lowest achin mechagoyim shpatim by the om is that God never revealed the law to them to do anything beyond what they already have, which is their security and their orderly society. The purpose of our law is to create moral individuals. Okay?
So that's the answer. There's a deeper
point to our law. I will see that confusing every single discussion if you look at the difference between the two. And that seems to be the purpose of the book. It tries to show the difference in these... In these aspects.
Okay. Same but just like, does it hang the part or this?
No. You have the front, this is some schneis and the column. But we're not up to that yet. That's going to be later in the semester. I will, if you see the page numbers at the top, okay, they go down. We started about page 26. Can you see that? Parashas Mishpatim will begin on page 46. Okay, page 46 will be the beginning of Parashas Mishpatim. What I'd like you to read over the Shabbos is the beginning, which starts on page 27, just until there. Right? Just read the. The footnotes are not going to be. This is my last one, so. Because this is online also, okay? YU.edu. Alright, so just read from 27 to 46 over Shabbos. Just the top part. Okay? If you remove the just read the. It's only about five or six pages if you just take out the bottom part. Okay. So what I'd like to do, just to conclude today's class, and then we'll get moving. This is just from now on. What we'll be doing is you'll need a acrostic, all of shmos. We'll have our Torah Shabbat here, and we'll have the comparison with the ancient codes there. Right? Got it? You'll need a shmos mikros gedolos. Because the course is called for Parshas Mishpatim and then Parshas Kedoshim. Right? And we're only doing the first half of Mishpatim, which is the casuistic law compared to the Okay? Let's get back to Mishnah comparison. I want to compare. We're talking about ownership of a human being. Right? This is the first time where we see a storyline of ownership of a human being. I'm going to talk about Hagar with Sarah. A male slave is called an Eved, a male who does Hebrew, but there's no Hebrew word in Avda. Female Eved is called a Shifra. Okay. It doesn't stem from a Hebrew word either, I don't think. Okay. It stems from an Akkadian word that also means someone who does things for you. It's interesting that the word for slave has to borrow from other languages. Okay? That's an interesting thing in itself. Hebrew is... And there are ancient languages that help us understand difficult Hebrew words. Right? And... But the thing is that we've always had Hebrew speakers all this time. Right? So the Hebrew of 3,000 years ago is quite comprehensible to us. In other words, if you know the Tanakh well, you could probably go to Israel now and order food in a restaurant. Right? Or the same is true this way. You are a modern Israeli, but you never opened the Tanakh. But you speak fluent Hebrew. You could probably make your way through learn some basic points about how biblical grammar works, and you'll probably be able to make your way through Tanakh. Right? As opposed to, let's say, you ever try to make your way through Shakespeare, or better yet, Beowulf or Canterbury Tales? That's just 1,000 years. Look how much English has evolved in just that short time. There's always been English speakers, right? The Hebrew of the Tanakh is so accessible to us, right? Because there's always been people studying, commenting on, learning, right? So it's interesting. Maybe another example of this: when Avraham purchases land, he gives money that is over la socher, not a Hebrew word. Right? This is not a Hebrew word. This is also an Akkadian word that means a merchant. Jews weren't merchants at the time, so they had to borrow a word from another language Outside of the book of Yonah, the word for sailor is yode on the yot, or your day on the yot. People who know ships or people who go into ships. That means that's a very big, the people who come up with a word like that, either it's poetic or they don't have too many sailors, otherwise they would have come up with a word for sailor. What's interesting is that in Yonah, describing non-Jewish sailors, the word is the current modern word for sailor, maloch. In Akkadian, mam means to know, and aloch is a ship. Right? We just took the Akkadian word for yodei on the yod. Right? There was recently a great work. I worked on one letter, another chaf. It's a lexicon to the Akkadian language. It's amazing, amazing, helps his understanding Hebrew and various intricacies of difficult Hebrew words immensely. Right. Okay, and it's just taken from all archaeological finds, including Akkadian. The Akkadian isn't the only language that we can use to help ourselves with these issues. We can use Ugaritic. They should at least be Semitic in nature. Look, The Gemara, if you've been away around in Shas a little, sometimes uses Greek languages, sometimes uses African, Chum languages to help explain difficult Hebrew words. Right? What does totafot mean? Totafot, that's not a Hebrew word. I know the totafot, but in Gemara in Maseches Menachos uses African languages to help shed light on what totafot means. The Gemara is constantly telling us Greek words that shed light on Hebrew. We borrow from each other. That's okay. It's perfectly okay. Right? Once it's in the Bible, it becomes Hebrew. Right? Chutzpah is not an English word, but you can use it in Scrabble. It's been co-opted by English. Right? Anyway, I find it interesting that the true meaning of the Eved / Shivcha needs to be borrowed from other languages to really get to what the word means. Because owning another person is not really a value of eyes, Avram and Sarah own people. Right? I'm going to talk about Hagar now. It says, Hanefesh asher asu b'choron. Right? Now you know the Rashi on that, right? Rashi says, what does it mean, Hanefesh asher asu b'choron? Rashi gives two perushim. One is the people that they purchased. But then Rashi says, no, Chas v'Shalom, Avram and Sarah wouldn't purchase people. Hanefesh asher asu b'choron means the Balei Tshuva that they made. Yeah, they made nefashos. They were in the business of making nefashos. Pshat is pshat. But let's see what the story with Hagar is. Right? And for this, I want you to be familiar with a book called Understanding Genesis. Understanding Genesis. The author is named Nachum Sarna, also wrote a book, Understanding Exodus. And we'll be using some of it also later this semester. Understanding Genesis and then Understanding Exodus, where he also compares storylines and Bereishis to ancient stories. And lo and behold, there is a law in numerous ancient codes that tell what are you supposed to do? No such law in the Torah, by the way. We just learn it from this story. What are you supposed to do if your man and a woman are married a certain amount of time and she does not bear him children? What shall be done? Do you know a Gemara that says what you should do? Take another wife. What's the timeline, you know? It's 10 years. Married 10 years without a child. Grounds for divorce, or be grounds for divorce, and they can divorce his wife for any reason. But according to the Torah.
Why divorce? Why just take another wife?
Take another wife, of course, yeah, that's what the Torah says.
But why are you supposed to separate her?
You don't have to. Yeah. The man might want to divorce her if he says, I can't afford two wives.
In modern times, now that you're not allowed one wife, are you supposed to divorce her?
No, there are all kinds of excuses for this, and it's Machlokas Rashi and Ramban about what the Gemara means about this, but it's Gemara and Yevamos. But you know where we derive this from? Because it says, when Avram was living with Sarah in Israel, it says, after 10 years of being in Israel, Sarah gave Avram the advice, take Hagar. He didn't do it on his own, he only did it what she said. Right? But it's not a law code in the Torah. It's not something that's actually written as a law.
This is
Shapiro. Yeah, good, exactly. This is Shapiro. Right? This is a story of heroes, and we learn from what they did for our actions. Good. So she convinces him, and he takes her. And the law codes seem to be aware of what could happen. It says, what if the woman gives birth to a child I skipped something. The woman who is the gveris, the wife, who's going 10 years without children, she shall pick, not the husband, she shall pick a woman she thinks will be loyal to her to bear a child with her husband. Right? Someone subservient to her, won't turn on her. Right? As you can imagine, that if this new woman has a child when the first wife doesn't, that the new woman may want to, hey, I'm the queen mother here. I've got the child. You're sitting around. You don't have nothing. The woman, the head of the household, shall be the first wife. She shall take a woman who will be loyal and subservient to her. So what does Sarah do? She takes a shifcha.
Harshivcha. Right? She didn't tell Avram go find another pretty woman. Harshivcha. Right?
Avram at first walks. And he doesn't want to do it. How do I know? Because the next pasuk after Sarah advises him is Batikach Sarah Yishas Avram. It doesn't say that Yikach Avram is Hogar Lisha. It says Batikach Sarah insisted. She took the woman and said, take a sheep. Acting just in accordance with ancient law. It's Sarah's decision. She finds the woman. She advises the husband. The husband really, in this case, doesn't really want to do it, but he goes along with her. She's doing physically very, very unselfish. I know my husband is part of this grand plan of being a great nation. I'm willing to give up my place in that nation so that my husband has a child. Right? God never said he would be a great nation with me. He just said he'd be a great nation. Because all this time we're married. Nothing's going on. Right? So, do it, be a great nation with Hagar. Right? What happens? Hagar conceives. And it says, Vatekal gvirta be'ineha. This woman made light of Sarah. She's saying, but this is how she behaves when she conceives. Imagine how she's going to behave when she gives birth. Right? She's going to take over my household. So the cuneiform law tells what you should do if that happens. Right? Wait until the woman gives birth. Can you finish what you think is going on here? Take the child. Send out the mother. It says, free the mother. She's no longer your shidduch. You have to give her freedom. You keep the child.
Why are you able to separate a mother from her child?
That's what it says in all these codes.
Take
the child. Because you hired her, you gave it to your husband in order to get a child in the family.
It's her husband's
child. It's his child, so now he can be.
Also her child, it's not your child.
I agree with you in terms of the point that you're making.
What's the reasoning for that law? Because that seems pretty severe.
Yeah, because she's a surrogate motherhood. She's a surrogate mother. We made a deal.
The deal is marriage, wasn't surrogacy.
The deal is if the woman, this is what she should do, make sure to take someone's serving.
I'm saying this is the first time it ever happened, right? That it's recorded. No,
it's,
that we know about.
Because it's in the Torah. But according to
Avram and.
Yeah, but 500 years before Avram did this, you have law codes that say what to do under these circumstances.
Well, who wrote those laws?
Babylonian, Sumerian.
This is what they did in Babylonian.
Yes, I'm just telling you. They have law codes written on the books. They don't know what the Torah is going to write. The story about Hagar is written 500 years after it happens. Right? So these law codes describe what to do if there's a falling out between the mother, the shivcha, the subservient, and the gveris, the queen mother, the head of the household, who appointed her to do this. Usually the falling out happens years after she gives birth. But in the case of the story in the Torah, the falling out happens while she's pregnant. And she says, now she's like that. The Torah doesn't tell us how Hagar made light of Sarah. That I have oral traditions. Maybe here the Rashi brings down a few stories. She would tell, she would go out in the marketplace and say, Sarah is such a wicked woman. She's with Avram all this time. And because until Hagar gave birth, someone might have thought maybe it's Avram who's responsible for not bearing children. Maybe Sarah would have a child with another man. But right after, as soon as she says, Mibiri Shona, was with him once, bang. And she's with him so many years, I'm much greater than she is. And she would walk around showing off her belly to Sarah and start walking in and asking what kind of clothes I should. It'd be very sensitive. Right? So Sarah is very hurt by this. Okay? Sarah changes and starts to afflict her. Rabban. Rabban Alator. Rabban says that because Sarah acted in such a uncharacteristic, she became very addicted against Hagar, right? That's why Hagar's descendants, call them Hagarim, call them Arabs, call them Ishmael, whatever you want to call them. Hagar's descendants, now Ramban is writing this in the 13th century, by that time the Muslims were
You know, you think maybe compared to Christians, things were a little better. But the Muslims had their share of many, many pogroms, forced conversions and the like of Jews throughout the Middle Ages. So for someone to write in the 13th century that the reason why the Muslims abuse us so significantly is because Sora abused Hagar originally, that's the way Rabban writes it, the favorites would say gracious. Right? That's my great biblical personalities course. That's the one, right? You in the net? Which one?
This one is the Gillis class.
Oh. So Ramban understood everything that happens to us throughout history as a function of stories and safer breaches. So why are we suffering from Muslim misrule? Because of Sarah who mistreated Hagar. Amazing. But then somehow the child, the woman comes back. The angel tells her, go back to Sarah. Your child will be a great man, great nation. But only if you go back to Sarah and he's raised by Abraham. So she goes back, the child is born. And then the child becomes a bad influence on the child that Sarah has. Right? And there, remember what she says, Goracious Allah, send out that woman. She behaves much better than the ancient convention, exactly what you said when you objected to. It's so cool that you keep the baby. See, Sarah, when she kicks out Hagar, I say she kicks out because that's Goracious, but Goracious can also mean free her. She's telling Abraham, free her, and let her take the child. I've got my own child. She's acting better than the ancient convention. The ancient convention is send her back to her people and I'm keeping the child. Right? If I raise the child the way I want to, the child won't behave this way. It won't be mitzachek. Right? So you get it? The Torah points out that the Sarah acts better than what's going on in the ancient world. She says, let her go free, set her free, and let her keep the child. Cruelty of the ancient world where you keep the child, send a woman free to keep the child. It's so cruel. A woman has to go and leave her child behind? Right? But they don't care about sensitivity, you know, in Sumeria and in Ugarit, you know. Okay? Alright, so that's going to be the conclusion of our introduction of human ownership. Own another human. Next class, make sure you come with the shmos, because we have to be able to see the psukim inside, and we'll start to prepare. This Parshas Mishpatim with the ancient codes.